We are back, and we're about to get in to the world of ancient aliens. We're going to be talking with Philip Copins. He's an author, investigative journalist, and he has explored the various ancient civilizations, the traditions, the folklore, and has discovered a web that has been woven through history. And it's something that is really inescapable if you're looking at it from this perspective of a larger reality. And we're going to talk about the NASCAR lines, talk about the pyramids, we're going to talk about Egypt, we're going to talk about his research into all areas, and especially NASA. And you'd be surprised what kind of research NASA has been doing with our tax dollars lately. They are convinced that life came from the outer space, and they are trying to prove it almost as much as we are. Stay tuned, coming right back. We're back on Coast to Coast AM, talking with Philip Copins. His website is linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. Philip, welcome to the program. If you're there, Philip, or maybe you have been abducted.
I'm here.
Ah, lovely. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Ah, it's absolutely a pleasure. Now, this is something that I know you've spent many years researching. Your website is really informative of all these different places, the mysteries that occupy the monolithic structures and the and ancient monuments. What led you into the pursuit of these mysteries?
Well, I was an investigative journalist. I was interested in the world of politics, specifically how people who, you know, we see on television an awful lot really weren't the ones in charge. And quite often that, you know, they are very much the public billboard for civil servants or other people behind the scenes. Mm. Now, you know, today that might not be as new as it once was, but about two decades ago it was still relatively new. And just remember that the Berlin Wall had fallen, and we were coming up to the 30th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination commemoration in 1993. And because of all of this new information which was happening in the former Soviet bloc, basically, the way it went was that Oswald had left, the alleged assassin of Kennedy, had left Russia via Holland. And Holland was very close to Belgium, where I was living and working. And a few details about Oswald in Rotterdam in the Netherlands, how he made his way back to America, really didn't kind of like sit well. For example, he had an American Express credit card, which was kind of weird. For a guy who just defected, you know, from Russia back to America. And all of these things basically put me onto the Kennedy assassination. And at that moment in time, there was a guy called Bill Moore, and he claimed that Kennedy was assassinated because he knew about UFOs and he was going to tell everybody the secret about UFOs. And I knew about UFOs, but pretty much that was it. And so I rushed to the library because there was hardly any such a thing as an internet. I found books about UFOs. I also found the books of Eric von Däniken and various other people who pushed the UFO question back into ancient times. Hmm. And then by a coincidence, I was asked by a publisher to actually promote two books into the English language. It was a Belgian publisher. And one book was on the mystery of Raoul Chateau, which obviously became famous because of the entire Dan Brown Da Vinci Code later. And the other book was on the megalithic civilization and Atlantis. And because of that, I began to make inquiries, and it is how I found out you know, that there was indeed far more mystery to the ancient history than we actually thought or read about. And so I pretty much left the world of politics, so to speak, though I continue to quite often write about these things for magazines like Nexus. But most of the time, my articles and my interests are now into the weird and wonderful world of esoterics, ancient history, you know, the various alternative fields, rather than the rather, well, more dangerous corners of politics and who is behind what.
Yeah, and the inevitable question that goes along with it is, are we alone in this galaxy? And if not, has this affected mankind? What is your opinion, after going through all this, whether or not mankind has been visited in the past, either by extraterrestrials or extra dimensionals?
Well, I think indeed we need to kind of get rid of this idea of extraterrestrial. It's very limited. It's almost saying, you know, ET has to be in a physical form, or otherwise it's not that important. And I think we really need to let go of that. I think we need to say a non-human intelligence will be able to contact us one way or another, and it doesn't necessarily have to be physical. It doesn't have necessarily have to be via radio. It could be psychic. It could be in so many ways. When we're looking at, you know, the sort of kind of technology which is being developed, my 10-year-old stepson just bought a game called Mindflex or something like that just the other day, and it really is kind of like a game whereby one set reads your brain waves and then lets the ball float, you know, on a fan, and it's wonderful and it's bizarre, and it's great to have, and it's one of these things whereby, you know, we are developing games whereby the game reads our mind, so to speak, and for the fabric of the universe to really be based on thought, which is what quantum physics is saying, really we should be talking about a far wider framework. Now, were we alone? Are we alone? Yeah, the one thing we can say is this. We, our ancestors, definitely believed we were not alone. And that, I think, is very important. Quite often people who are critics of the ancient alien theory are saying, well, you know, you're not giving our ancestors due credit. You're telling them that they weren't intelligent enough, that they are stupid savages, that they were only able to build this and that with the help of extraterrestrial beings. And that is simply not the case, for the very single reason, which is that so many of these ancient cultures say that there was a time when the gods were there, that sometimes, you know, it just was an era thousands of years ago before pretty much civilization, but there are so many civilizations like the Mayan civilization who say that the gods lived amongst them. The Hopi people in Arizona speak of a time when the gods lived amongst them, that they then retired to the mountains and that eventually they disappeared and they are awaiting their return. So this is like, you know, a very basic, I think, fact which we need to say is that we live in a world where our ancestors believe that we were not alone. And then when you start looking at the archaeology and all the other aspects of our ancestors, you really begin to see that they were right. We were not alone. Unfortunately and bizarrely, we live in a world where we seem to have forgotten that, or we are in denial of these things, at least from an academic perspective. We officially do not want to accept, that our ancestors believed that we were not alone, and B, that, you know, we do not want to accept that we are alone. That's this weird tenet that somehow we did it all ourselves, that we are the summum of creation, that there is no such thing as a lost civilization, that everything is very linear. It happened from, you know, 4.5 billion years ago, and we are now at the summum of everything, and there was no anything in between, which is either unknown or lost. And it's a very weird concept to have, I think. And, you know, I'm perplexed by the linearity of scientific research, which just seems to pursue this.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It is a universal theme to have this phrase almost word for word pop up in these texts and these traditions from cultures that are separated by thousands of years and thousands of miles. But why is it, do you think, that if all the commonality of this experience of the gods were on Earth at that time in antiquity, how come they're not here now? What is the difference?
Well, I think the short answer is maybe they are. And there are also kind of like, you know, good reasons why they might not be. My parallel is always that in the 1960s, we went to the moon, and it was everybody's expectation, I think, that if we were able to get there, that we were going to continue exploring space. We were going to go to Mars. You know, it really was going to be a Star Trek. And guess what happened? You know, it didn't happen. Even Concorde is no longer flying. Everything has become quite mundane, and basic to some extent. And maybe that's the same reason why other civilizations have, you know, stopped contacting us. But I think really all the evidence is there that, that we are still being contacted, that these intelligences are out there. And I point that out in the book as well. I point out that some of these people, like Imhotep, not the guy from the Mummy movies, but the person who basically is credited with designing, creating the pyramid and new technique through which pyramids would be built. He was a high priest under Djoser, King Djoser, pretty much 5,000 years ago. Now, he is credited with having had communication with the gods. So whereas science says that he is a genius, actually he himself is saying, well, I might be a genius, but really I got this from the gods. I got the knowledge as to how to make certain substances from a non-human intelligence. And when we go to more recent times, the 1970s, you know, Terence McKenna was a dear friend for me for a few years until he unfortunately died. But Terence highlighted that when he made contact with non-human intelligences, they told him very interesting, you know, scientific aspects, like time is not some byproduct of gravity. Time is something which is real, and you human beings don't seem to realize that. He said that time was a fractal wave, and the mathematical equation for this was given to him by this non-human intelligence. You know, he began to do other aspects as to how certain new things occurred in certain moments in time. And all of these things, Terence was given by this non-human intelligence, and it is on par with what Imhotep was given 5,000 years ago. And I'm pretty sure that in between, there are various other people who will say that they have been given their information from non-human intelligences. I didn't have the pleasure of knowing Michael Talbot, but from everybody who did know him, they are saying that his book, The Holographic Universe, which basically says that the way the universe is like a holograph, you know, very much like the Star Trek special galley. He said that he got this information from non-human intelligences as well, in contact with these non-human intelligences. So there is very much, I think, out there thousands or at least hundreds of people who got their material from non-human intelligences. But I think the problem is that, you know, to be open about this, specifically in the Western kind of like mindset, is something which requires courage and also a certain determination. Do you want to be completely open as to how you get certain information, or do you just feel it is more important to get that information out there and withholding some of the aspects as to how you got it, knowing that by withholding this, you will actually be able to push that information far better out there in the world?
Right. We've heard this quite a bit, that these, that the Mayan calendar, these other great feats of human engineering were somehow assisted by these non-human intelligences. If you had to pick one monument on this planet, which one would you see as the most likeliest to be built by these, quote, alien intelligences, or at least help by?
I would say that it actually is pockets. And what I mean with that is this. When you look at a civilization like Peru, you have pyramids in North Peru, you have the Nazca Lines, and then you have what is quite often described as a sacred valley. It starts at the Bolivian Altiplano with Tiwanaku, continues down to Cusco, Ollantaytambo, and then obviously the famous Machu Picchu. Now, of all of those places, the places where the enigmatic materials are Tiwanaku, Pumapunku, Ollantaytambo, Cusco. And what you find is that this is also those places where the local mythology says that the deities were present. It is said that the civilizing deity Viracocha appeared at Lake Titicaca and walked down the sacred valley and brought civilization and did extraordinary things. And it is an interesting overlap that it is, you know, precisely in those places that you find these extraordinary engineering works. Pumapunku, if I had to choose just one, it would be Pumapunku, because it just defies belief. It is done at a level where you really think, like, why were you doing this? For example, one stone in which on one side there is an opening which is five-sided, and it makes a 90-degree bend to come out on the other side of the same stone, and it's become a six-sided opening. Now, why would you want to do that? What is the purpose of this? Yet somehow, you know, we had an ancestor, whether ET or not, who felt this was somehow useful for the application he was doing. The drill holes are so perfect, the way these stones are. And again, it is in a place where it is said that a civilizing deity, Viracocha, appeared pretty much out of nowhere. You know, you could call it the Stargate, and appeared and began his voyage on planet Earth throughout the Sacred Valley, and leaving not just Pumapunku as evidence behind, but also other places like Ollantaytambo and Cusco.
Well, do you think these sites, which have been studied so much by so many scientists, that there must be a conspiracy of silence, that they have come to the same conclusions, yet they're not talking about it or forbidden to talk about it?
I think they actually don't study these sites. But you know, I always go back to this example, which is the following. In the 1980s, carbon dating tests were done on the Great Pyramid and on the Second Pyramid in Giza. And these carbon dating results pretty much showed that those two pyramids were 500 years older than commonly accepted. So rather than 2,500 BC, they were roughly 2,900, 3,000 BC.
Okay.
This is non-contested. This is, you know, there is no doubt whatsoever that these carbon dating results are true and genuine. No contest. However, in the last 20 years, Egyptologists have not published these scientific publications. So they have not published these carbon dating results in a scientific publication, which means they can pretend as if they don't exist. Because for an Egyptologist, for it to become real, it has to have been published in a scientific publication. So which it basically means that this chronology, which they have created over the last 100, 150 years, they are keeping pretty much artificially alive by disregarding everything which is not fitting within that chronology. And it is not just carbon dating results. There is so much more than that. I was 3 years ago at a scientific conference on pyramids, and the leading lights of Egyptology were there, including the Dean of Ancients and Cairo University Archaeology Departments. And I was giving a very small lecture on pyramids, and pretty much kind of like saying that so much new research has been happening on pyramids in the last 20 years because of my book, which was then called The New Pyramid Age. And after my lecture, these professors came up to me and they said, like, really? There are pyramids in Peru and they are older than our pyramids? And I said, like, yeah. And I was flabbergasted to find out that, you know, like, leading lights of Egyptology, of pyramid research.
Hadn't heard of these ones.
Never heard of these ones.
Well, hold it right there. We're just at the break, and when we come back, we're going to talk much more with our guest, Philip Copins. His website is linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. We are back on Coast to Coast AM talking with Philip Copins about the ancient aliens theory. We're going to talk about Eric von Däniken, Zachariah Sitchin, and why science is so unwilling to listen to the ancient alien debate. All that right after the quick break. Stay right there. We're back on Coast to Coast AM. And Philip, just before the break, you were telling us about one of your lectures and how these scientists were unaware of these rather important documents, or rather monuments. Do you think that that's part of a concerted effort on the part of academia to filter knowledge? Or is it like the old expression goes that an expert is someone who knows more and more about less and less?
Both. There's definitely, on some artifacts, definitely a concerted effort to stop too much from getting out. One example, I think, is the Smithsonian. Wherever the Smithsonian turns up, you see that this is a redux of pretty much, you know, trying to reduce our understanding of our ancestors. You know, there's a famous story about the lost cave with alleged Egyptian artifacts in the Grand Canyon in Arizona. But specifically what I address, some people might say ad nauseum, is Jane Walsh's conclusions on crystal skulls.
Okay.
Crystal skulls, you know, have been rising in popularity, and, you know, the Sci-Fi Channel just today has been rerunning all Indiana Jones movies, and they are a worldwide phenomenon now. They are out there. And Jane Walsh from the Smithsonian, what happened basically is that at one point, a person gave a crystal skull of no importance whatsoever as a legacy after his death to the Smithsonian, and it ended up on Jane Walsh's desk. And she began to do some studies, and she came up with a theory that all crystal skulls, specifically the Mitchell Hedges one, was made in a German village at the end of the 19th century, and that this is the origin of all the crystal skulls, including one in the Paris Museum and one in the British Museum. Now, she has no evidence, I repeat, no evidence whatsoever for this conclusion. But she gets, you know, she gets airtime on National Geographic, she gets airtime in all the archaeological magazines with a theory which, again, has no evidence whatsoever. 2 years ago, she had the fortune to have the Mitchell Hedges skull come in for a short analysis. Bill Holman had recently become the caretaker after Anna Mitchell Hedges had passed away. And even though I wasn't there, I got to see the entire 3 hours of visits because they were interviewed. They were videoed. And basically what you see is one of her assistants kind of like, you know, jumping up and down and saying, oh, the jaw of the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull, which is, you know, intricate, which is beautiful. It's one of the very few crystal skulls which has a detachable jaw. He basically said, oh, that can't possibly be made from crystal. That has to be glass. And a few, you know, like, you know, an hour or so in, he does the analysis and it shows up that it is indeed crystal and that it isn't glass. And all of a sudden, he jumps to a different conclusion. It's almost as if the first hour has not happened. And he says, like, oh, well, yes, it's crystal, but it's definitely crystal from a different kind of origin than the rest of the skull. At which moment in time, Jane Walsh basically tells him to shut up. But she is, you know, a prime case whereby anything an archaeologist or an academic says gets automatically big headline news, even though there is no evidence for this whatsoever. These skulls, you know, every time you look at them, they are more than likely from a Central American origin. They come from tribes which are descendants of the Mayan people. Some of them were given to Westerners pretty much with the Mayan people, either thanking them for what Westerners did for them, quite often in the case of medicine. But also sometimes given to these Western people like Nick Nocerino, and in my opinion also Mitchell Hedges, to basically tell the world that the Mayans were not stupid savages, which is very much a mind frame up until, you know, the early 1990s, when all of a sudden interest in the Mayan civilization really began to propel and is what it is now with the entire 2012 phenomenon. But there is also the other current within academics, I think, and I think this is something which is going to come more and more to the forefront, which is that they have been taking government money, government funding, and have been doing very little with it. We seem to quite often, you know, the big world out there seems to think that scientists are really proper and do everything by the book. And the only time when that becomes quite not so much the case is when science becomes controversial. Climate science obviously is a very good example of that. And people then quite often think, oh, it's very straightforward. You have the proper scientists, and then you have the crook scientists who get employed by you know, BP, Shell, and everybody else. And reality is that it is simply not the case. There has been fakery in archaeology going on for hundreds of years. In 2001, the editors of archaeology were actually saying that there was so much fakery happening within the scientific reports that, you know, they felt that it was simply something which was so out of control that they felt something had to be done about it. Yet they themselves said that they couldn't write about it within the own pages of archaeology for fear of lawsuits and various other things. In all the excavations in Italy, 20% of the excavated material has been written down. 80% has never been written up, which means, you know, like whatever has been dug up about the Etruscan civilization, the Roman Empire, 80% of it really doesn't exist from an archaeological academic perspective. Yes, it was dug up, but it sits somewhere and nobody knows precisely where. And even if it, you know, sits somewhere from an academic point of view, it doesn't exist because, again, it hasn't been published in scientific journals, which is for academics like the base level entry from which they will start doing their research. So you have, you know, on the one hand, people within academics who are definitely out there to maintain a status quo. Jane Walsh is clearly one of them. The late Sahih Hawass, and I say late because he has finally been removed from his position as the mafia don of Egyptian antiquities, you know, definitely fits in that category as well. He basically had supreme power. You know, it was the Supreme Council of Antiquities. Well, he had supreme power. Every study on Egypt had to pass through his hands and through his approval before publication. If he did not agree with it and you published it, basically you and your academic affiliation would never dig in Egypt ever again. You know, it is pretty much almost like a mafia scheme. And, you know, so that is one side. And then you have obviously the other side of people, I think, who are relatively lazy, who can take 20 years to write a scientific paper about something which you've done 20 years before. And I think this is going to change. I think in the next few years, science is more and more going to come to the forefront. Once this political and financial turmoil has disappeared, science and academics are going to get intense scrutiny, because right now what they're doing is very little for an enormous amount of money which they're getting. And they're not investigating the areas where people really want to see, you know, answers. They pretend that things like the near-death experience is a field of study which they shouldn't study because it is too close to religion. And, you know, one of the incidences, because Ancient Aliens is such a popular TV series, each episode at the end of its lifetime across the world has been seen by about 100 million people. And so young people, students, go to their universities and colleges and ask their professors for, you know, questions about, professor, what do you think about Ancient Aliens? And there is one incident in February about a professor who blogged like that, who basically said, you know, he knew that we had not been visited by extraterrestrial beings in the past. And, you know, he didn't give any arguments. He just flat out stated that he knew. It is this declaration, this dogmatic declaration, which is, you know, not unique. It happens on so many subject areas. And, you know, again, to repeat, I think this is going to change. I think in the next few years, there is going to be more move towards making scientists accountable for the money they are given de facto, and that will leave, I think, to certain reconsiderations as to what they're doing. And I think it will also become more open. You know, politics has become more open. Everything has become more open. The music industry, with things like, you know, American Idol and X Factor, has completely become an open book to so many people. Science still is very much a closed ivory tower topic. But again, that is going to change.
Yeah, there's an establishment that is really hard to crack. And I think you mentioned the Smithsonian before, and they've often been criticized for when something gets discovered that doesn't fit into the accepted paradigm, they put it in a tiny little box, in a tiny little shelf, and there it sits almost forever, right?
Absolutely. You know, Ancient Aliens, I think it was season 2, featured the giant skulls in Lovelock, Nevada. Basically, gigantic skeletons have been found in a cave there. And you would think that every big museum is out to get it. Instead, it is, you know, the finds of originally roughly 15 of these giant skulls. One of them was put in a museum, which then completely disappeared. The other one is in a small museum, which I'm slightly exaggerating, has opening hours from 9:30 in the morning to 9:45 in the morning, one morning every 3 months, so to speak. And of the, I think, 7 skulls in their collection over the last few years, 4 of them have mysteriously disappeared.
So which museum is that?
It is the museum, I think it's in Reno, a suburb of Reno. And basically, you know, it's extraordinary to find that all of these things are not better preserved. You would think that extraordinary finds like gigantic skulls would receive massive attention. Instead, they are treated as if they are, you know, like, oh yeah, whatever, we will push them in the smallest museum possible. And it's a weird attitude, this idea that science is there to explore, you know, it's simply a fallacy.
Well, these gigantic bones have been pictured, photographed, and some of them are more credible than others. Do you think, just looking at that, for example, this race of giant man, does that go back to the Nephilim? Do you think there's a clear, unbroken chain of evidence to suggest that this is what was referred to in the Old Testament?
I'm not too sure whether there's a clear, unbroken line going back, but definitely the idea of you know, giant beings coming here and mating in the case of the biblical story with human females is definitely something which has been around. You know, it's something which comes up in so many aspects. And what I find interesting is that when you start, I think, you know, when you look at the Bible is often seen as this book of morals. But kind of when I was writing my book, I began to see the Bible as very much of a document of the Jewish people, of how they went about their business, how quite often their, you know, their tribe was put into peril, how they were exiled, how they were done to this and how they were done to that, but also of anomalies which happened. And the story of Ezekiel, with his weird abductions, his visions, you know, the story of Jonah, which is clearly not a whale, but something which is far more like a submarine. It's in there because the Jewish people are saying, okay, you might think that reality and what you see is like all there is, but here are accounts from people in prominent positions within our culture, which give a completely different picture. And I think the story of the Nephilim in the Bible is in there as well, for that simple reason. It describes something which happened at some point in the past, and they are saying, you know, like, this is what happened. And when you read it, it is very basic. It's you know, it says like, okay, these big beings came from the skies, made it with human females. After a certain period of time, children were created, were about to be born, and because of their giant skulls, they couldn't be born normally, which meant that some of the mothers died, and after a while, they seemed to figure out what was happening, and so cesarean sections were performed, which, you know, meant that the children and the mothers had a better chance of surviving. And what seems to have happened, I think, with the Bible is that at some point, this stories, these stories of you know, weird things happening, all of a sudden were felt to need to have a moral to them. And I don't think that's the way the Bible was written in origin. I think it was an account of weird things happening to them. And I think when you read the stories of Ezekiel and specifically of the giants, the Nephilim in that perspective, I think it makes more sense. There is no moral there. But, you know, you find these stories of gigantic human beings definitely in various places. In my book, I also go into the biblical longevity. Again, science is saying, oh, well, you know, Methuselah or Adam, all of these people in the Bible have lifespans of 900 odd years. And the scientists say, well, you know, they probably were using a lunar calendar, so you have to divide it all by roughly 12, and then you get perfectly normal human lifespans. These people therefore lived within a lifespan of 70, 80 years. Well, if you do that, let's then also look at what else is in there, which is that it also gives the date as to when they fathered children. And in that case, you have the likes of, you know, these biblical patriarchs having children at the age of five. And that is kind of like, you know, something weird there. And then, you know, when you start looking into what they are, the fact that Moses definitely has a preference for being clothed around his people, with apparent rumors that he doesn't look 100%, you know, as a human being. Also, the story when he takes his people to Israel, that they get confronted with tribes, some of which are descendants of these Nephilim, of these giant beings, and that they have to fight these descendants of these tribes still living there for basically territory, for you know, being there in Israel. So there is definitely evidence, which, you know, some of it is archaeological, some of it is biblical, some of it is folkloric, some of it is of another nature, to say that we were not alone, that there were these giant beings. And, you know, to some extent, the question can indeed be, what is there left to be discovered once we really start looking into some of the places where these beings might have lived?
Yeah. Well, when you talk about technology that these Nephilim used to get here, and the Mayan calendar and the wheels within wheels from Ezekiel, I wonder, Eric Von Däniken originally said that either our ancestors were more technologically advanced than we were, or that extraterrestrials must have been here. Which do you think it is?
I think it's an end universe. I think both of these cases are true. And I think the Nazca Lines is probably the best example for that. When he first asked the question about the Nazca Lines, you know, like, what are these things? He said, these things should be seen from above. And everybody thought, okay, this means straightforward extraterrestrials. Well, in 1968, when he asked the question about the Nazca Lines, nobody had been looking at these lines. The only person interested was a German woman called Maria Reiki. And Eric really pushed science into addressing this civilization. Now we know that the Nazca Lines are part of a larger complex. There are pyramids there. There are mummies there.
Oh, yeah. We're going to talk about that. We're just at the break. When we come back, we're going to get right back into the Nazca Lines. And I have some questions that some of the listeners have asked me to ask, and I will. That is a whole nother ball of wax. We're talking with Philip Copins here on Coast to Coast AM. My name is Rob Simone.